Jim is our 10-minute speaker from Visalia. Welcome.
Wow, this meeting is honest. Wow. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, that was a good beginning there. I'm an alcoholic because I got this chip. Oh, wait. No, I'm an alcoholic because I've been drinking for many years of my life, starting in high school and continuing for about 29 years since. I got to start with a prayer here that I'd like to start with, and it's an official AA prayer because it's in this blue book that Pat was talking about here, so I think it's legal. It's the third step prayer. It goes something like this. It goes, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. That's a good prayer. I was going to talk to you about honesty. After that introduction, I was like, "Oh, I have so much fear right now." So I got fear in me going on here. But through this program, I've learned to overcome a lot of those obstacles. One of those. Well, let me get on to this. When I was 15, I wish somebody brought me this pamphlet, and I'm going to go through it quickly here. And somebody thought about this 55 years before I became an alcoholic. Have I tried to stop drinking for a week or so, but could not do it? Have I wished people would stop talking about my drinking? Have I changed drinks to try not to get drunk? Do I ever need a drink to get going in the morning? Do I envy people who can drink without getting into trouble? Does my drinking cause problems at home? Does my drinking cause problems with other people? Do I try to get extra drinks? Have I tried to stop drinking but still got drunk? Have I missed work or cut school because of drinking? And do I have blackouts, times I cannot remember? Would my life be better if I quit drinking?
Yeah.
You know what? I love that last question right there because since I want to say joined AA, not really joining. Since I was forced into AA by all that I value, my life is much better because I'm in this program. I wish somebody back in my youth might have told me there was a better way to go through life besides all the drinking. I used my drinking to meet girls. I used my drinking to study for tests because lawyers always drank and they were really smart. So I thought, if I just drink some vodka before I go take this test, I think I'll do better on it. That might have been alcoholic thinking because it didn't work for me. I used drinking to overcome my fears. When somebody would make me mad, I would drink. When somebody would make me happy, I would drink. There was not a lot of in between. There was always a moment to drink, no matter what. And my favorite drink would last all the way until the evening, until I blacked out or passed out or threw up or something. And that was many, 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 many nights of my life, many hundreds, thousands of my nights throughout my life. Now, it wasn't always, I didn't get drunk, I don't think, every night, but I was always thinking about drinking, or I'd always be thinking about the weekend ahead, or getting wasted with my friends, or partying, just something like that. And I did that for 29 years until the day I decided, you know what, I'm going to try something different today. I'm going to not drink tonight. I'm going to this really fancy wedding. I just heard about this wedding. Everybody was talking about it for weeks. It was going to be at the country club, a beautiful setting by the swans and the fish and everything out there in the Visalia Country Club. Some of you golfers might know it. And it was a big, this wedding must have cost $500,000 or something. It was incredible. So I decided I'm not drinking tonight. This is it. I'm going to stay sober at this wedding so I don't make a fool of myself. So I took a few Xanax. I popped 4 Xanax in before the wedding. Because that was my best thinking at the time, that I won't drink if I take some pills. And I thought, it'll calm me down. It's like drinking a few beers. I'm good. Well, I get to the wedding, and we're taking pictures. Everything's really nice. I have to go to the bathroom eventually, and I'm not drinking. And I walk out back by the caddy shack, and the groom's party's out there. And the groom asks me, hey, Uncle Jim, come and grab a beer. And I'm like, oh, yeah, one beer won't hurt. Well, that one beer turned into they left an immediate second beer. And I have this cute little nickname now called Two Beer Jim. And that was all it took for that evening. Because as soon as I walked in to the Golden Arches of the open bar, which was like the size of the back of this room, with every drink you could possibly imagine, and it was all free, and everybody was my friend at the bar. It was like the best. I didn't know any of them, but they were awesome. And we were drinking together and having a wonderful, wonderful time. And then I went to the table, and they had bottles of wine on the table. And then I woke up, and I'm calling my sister-in-law a bitch, whose wedding this is. And my wife is crying. One of my kids are over there with grandma crying. And I'm like, and that's when I came to at this moment. And I'm like, this is bad. So I accused them of, you know, hurting me and making my life miserable. And then I was escorted properly out of the wedding, crying and bawling all the way back home again. Waking up the next morning and my family was gone. The kids were gone. And there was a note that says, get out of the house. And when I come back, I don't want you at the house anymore. And this isn't the first time I've been kicked out of the house. There's been many, many events throughout my marriage that I've been excluded from the family, and sleeping in hotels, and being removed from the family. I walked into a Red Cross meeting Sunday night. They introduced the big book. I met new friends. I got to tell you one last thing. I have a young niece, beautiful young lady, much younger than me. And she calls me up the next morning after the wedding, and she goes, hey, Uncle Jim, I heard you had a great time last night. And she's an AA, so this is funny to her. She's probably having a ball with this. And she goes, I'll be by picking up later on to get to go to a meeting tonight. I'm like, oh. I'm like, and I knew what she meant. I knew what she meant because she was in the program, and I thought she was weird. So, you know, who can't control their alcohol? At any rate, she brought me into the program. And I'm here today, and I'm speaking in front of you with an open and honest heart that this has been truly an incredible experience and the best part of my life. We were eating dinner tonight with a bunch of your brothers and sisters, and just being in a Mexican restaurant sober is a blessing, and not drinking the margaritas and getting drunk and stumbling out of there. Today I have a sponsor, and I have friends in AA. I read my big book. I pray. I go to meetings, I take on service positions, and I think I'm going to keep doing this until my hair completely grays out, because I don't know any other way that I won't get drunk. So this works for me, and I hope you might find a place here for you too. So, and I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic.
It is my great pleasure to introduce my friend Bill from Visalia, who will be our 45-minute speaker. Bill?
Thank you. see. I got to update my Facebook status so everybody knows. I am so glad that that went over well. I was afraid to start off badly. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Bill Hatzman. And I hope to share with you the story of what's happened in my life as a result of alcohol and alcoholism, and most importantly, Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't always believe this, but in my saner moments, I do believe that there's really nothing spectacular about me. I think I'm just another one of God's kids, and that we're all equally created different. The trouble is, though, that my mind wants to convince me that somehow, some way, I might be just a little bit more equal than the rest of you. I don't think I'm particularly special, but I do believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is something very special. I like to think of Alcoholics Anonymous as, I like to think of being a participant in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as having a front row seat at the God Show. And what has happened in the short time that I've been here with you is a clear demonstration of the absolutely impossible happening time and time and time again. I hope that some of what I tell you tonight illustrates that. One of the things that I really struggled with when I first came into contact with AA was this word God, and all this talk about God, and I saw them passing the plate, and I was reminded of, you know, church, and I remembered the way I felt and the things that I thought in that kind of environment. And you know, the funny thing is, I was raised by perfectly well-meaning people. They exposed me to a lot of really good things. I got a great education here in the state of California. I was exposed to a particular religion that my family practiced. And given all the things that were afforded to me, what I'm about to tell you makes absolutely no sense. But it is my experience. When I got here, and there was mention about prayer and meditation and the importance of it, I really felt like I had no foundation upon which to start that journey. I believed that I did not know how to pray. And I don't know where I got that notion, but that's what I brought here. And one of the things that I was encouraged to do early on was if I had something that I wanted to improve or learn, that I might go to people who seem to be specialists in that particular field and learn from them. And so, look, I'm not selling Bibles. I'm not trying to get you to go to church. That's not my point at all. But for me, I got involved with some people that were doing that kind of shtick, right? And they helped me to learn how to pray. And I'm just thinking there's a possibility there might be even one person in the room tonight that might be in the same place that I was in. And if that one person is here, then what I'm about to do hopefully won't be wasted. What I'd like to do is share with you a prayer that I have used through much of the time that I've been sober. I say this prayer very frequently. I do find from time to time that prayer can become sort of routine. And when it becomes routine, I find myself like saying words and not knowing what I'm saying. And so I got to kind of stop that and do something different to break out of it. But in any case, and what I'd like to do is include you in my prayer tonight. So if this bothers you, I apologize. That's not my intention. And if this helps you, I'll just be overjoyed. Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for another sober day here on earth. I want to thank you for the blessings that you've put in our lives. I want to ask you to help us to see, to share, and to be good stewards with all of them. Lord, I pray that every single one of us, that we would become the men and women that you would have us be. I pray that you would show us your plans for us today, and that you would give us the willingness and the strength and the courage to follow that plan. I pray, Lord, for all of your children, that they would come to know you, that they would find the love and the joy and the peace and the freedom that we found in you. We pray for your healing touch and for all those who are suffering. We pray that they would find comfort in you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen. That's become an important part of my life. And that's kind of a formal prayer. Sometimes prayer takes a much less formal disposition in my life. I have tried to develop something. The word that really talks to me about this God thing is relationship. Right, this having something, some I don't want to say person, but something that I can communicate with, and prayer is how I understand that I talk to God, and meditation is one way that I understand that I hear back from Him. Another way I hear back from Him is God has a funny way of wearing skin, and I see God in so many of the people that I encounter from day to day. So. Anyway, hopefully that'll be helpful. I wanted to, I claim to be an alcoholic. I think Jim did a great job of describing that, and I know we read about it enough. I think sometimes people like me can make things like this too difficult. I mean, there's a little portion. I think it's chapter 4 where it talks about this, but it says if you find that when you drink you can't control the amount that you drink, or if when you try to quit entirely that you can't, then you might be alcoholic. And I've been told that that's essentially a description of an alcoholic. I think the guys who wrote the book decided that if they were going to define alcoholic, then a guy like me would find where something didn't apply and then this didn't matter to me and I could go do something different. But it's important for me to keep in my mind the truth about my relationship with alcohol. And that is very simply said, that when I'm sober, my mind will find a way to trick me into thinking that somehow, some way, I can take another drink, and this time it'll be different. And once I start to drink, I get thirsty. It's a crazy thing. Drinking makes me thirsty, you know. I wanted to try to follow a general format. You know, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. With regard to what I was like, I want to tell you two stories to contrast one another. The first time I remember going to a dance was in, I think it was the seventh grade, and there was a young girl in my class who I had my eye on. I wanted to make her mine. Truth be told, I don't know that I know what the heck I would have done with her if I'd have caught her, but somehow I wanted to make her mine. And there was this dance coming up, and I thought, this is my opportunity. And I went home and I took a shower again, in the afternoon. Wow, who does that? I took my dad's razor and I rubbed it against my cheeks, and then I used his Aqua Velva, I combed my hair just right. I put on my favorite jeans and my favorite shirt, and I went off to the dance. And I got to the dance, and just at the door there, they were letting us in, and I could see her, and she was over there across the hall talking to her friends, and they kind of looked over my way, and they started giggling. And I don't know why, but for some reason I was convinced that there was something wrong with me and that they were laughing about me. And what I did that night is I kind of eased my way into the dance. I stood up against the wall, kind of leaned up against it most of the night. I watched a bunch of people have fun, and I really envied them all. I was afraid of being rejected, and that kept me from participating. And So now I compare that to my first dance as a freshman in high school. I got picked up with some kids that were on my swim team. They were a little bit older than me, so they drove. And when I got in the back seat of the car, there was a tall can of beer in the back. And I asked them if I could have it. Now, I'll tell you, I had tasted beer before. I'll be honest with you, I didn't really care for it. I didn't drink it for the taste. I drank it because I wanted to fit in and because I wanted to be part of. Well, I guess that's the same thing. And so I drank that beer and I went into the dance, and I had an entirely different experience. I danced like a fool that night, and I asked all kinds of girls to dance, you know. And the funny thing is that there were more than a few that declined my invitation, but my reaction to that was far different than I had anticipated a couple years before. I had the notion that that she just didn't know what she was missing. And so I went on to the next one. And look, my story is maybe a little bit vanilla in some regards. I didn't have access to alcohol as a youngster, not very often anyway. Like probably a lot of us that grew up in the Central Valley, there would be keg parties out in the country on a weekend night. And when I got the opportunity to drink, I would. And you know, most of those experiences weren't entirely noteworthy, right? I mean, we went out, we had a good time, and every once in a while, somebody'd get in an argument, or somebody'd have to leave real fast to avoid one, or, okay, once in a while, I think I, you know, ran some puke down the side of my friend's car on the way out, you know, whatever. So, you know, those kinds of things happen, but the night of that dance, there was something that happened that I didn't recognize at the time. I'm going to go back to the dance. That particular night, I got home from the dance. I went to my home. I got home on time. There were no accidents. There were no fights. There was no money that shouldn't be spent. There were no broken hearts. There was really none of the telltale signs of a problem that happened that night. And it would only be many years later that I realized that something very tragic had happened that night. And what happened to me is that I began to believe two lies. And one of the lies that I believed was that other people liked me better when I had a little something in my system. And the other lie that I believed was that somehow I was a better version of myself under the influence. And I didn't want to deny you of that presence. So like I said, then we went on, and I drank when I got a chance, but I didn't drink that often, frankly. Later on in life, that began to change. I began to get greater access to alcohol. This especially happened when I joined the service and was able to buy alcohol legally. I developed something of a pattern of drinking. The thing is I just didn't see it happening. I didn't see the role that alcohol was taking in my life becoming more and more prominent. I didn't see that, you know, if a friend of mine wanted to go have dinner at a restaurant and they didn't serve what I wanted to drink, I would find a way to talk him into going to a place that would, you know, serve what I wanted to drink. My world started to get a little bit smaller year over year. And one of the things that began to happen was I would have this experience that I hear people talk about having a blackout. And what I mean when I say I had a blackout is the next morning I would have to be informed by other people what had happened the night before. These conditions kind of evolved over time where it wasn't just, you know, funny stuff. And it got to where it wasn't so funny. It got to be kind of disturbing after a while. But there were those times when I would come to or wake up and I wouldn't know where I was or how I got there. And that can be a little bit disturbing. I remember one of the most disturbing events. I can just see myself in this picture still today. I woke up in my bed, but I had no clue how I had gotten there. I could not remember much of anything past the second martini that night, and I was afraid that I had possibly hurt someone. And so I got out of the bed, I mean, with a terrible headache. I got out of the bed. I ran outside to check my car to make sure that there was no blood or bumps on my car. And, you know, I think most people that experience those kinds of things might reconsider their behavior. But the trouble for me is that I see those circumstances as just being merely coincidences or bad luck. I don't see the correlation between my drinking and these outcomes. And so I continue to drink and I continue to drink, and I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but I also have this other sort of notion in my mind. And the notion that I have is that rules are really good for you, but I really don't need to abide by them. You know, I think that speed limits are good, and as long as you guys stick to them, I can drive around you, and we'll all be fine. My problem with that kind of thinking is it leads me to behave in ways that are frankly reckless. And frankly, are contrary to my own values. And over a number of years, as the condition of alcoholism was progressing in my life, I ended up finding myself on a skiing. I met a friend out at Lake Havasu, and our intention that weekend was to rent a boat, to go out, do some skiing, chase some girls, and get drunk. And not necessarily in that order. And on the way into Lake Havasu, they had these billboards that had signs that had said, you know, don't operate a watercraft under the influence. And then they had a picture of a guy, you know, with the handcuffs on, getting in the police car. And I saw that sign and I thought, you know, that's good looking out, because some people get reckless. And and then when I got closer to town and we picked up the local radio station, they had radio spots going. And then when I got into town and saw television that night, they had TV ads. This is all Memorial Day weekend of 1998. And if you ever hear a recording of me telling this story, I was wrong before. Some of the details I've had to look into a little more. But my buddy and I, we decided we were going to go down Saturday morning to get the boat. And, you know, we had to stop and get the beer first. And I can still see myself walking in that grocery store. And I had this really sick feeling in my stomach about that decision. I knew that this was not a good plan, and yet I just kept going. And we went and we got the boat, and we drank and did crazy stuff all day, and then we decided we wanted to go skiing later on. And the short end to what could be a really long story is that when my friend got out to ski and then he fell and I brought the boat back around to pick him up, I thought it would be really funny to throw a wake of water at him, and I struck him with the propeller, and I injured him pretty bad. I still don't really, I really can't even imagine how it is that I managed to get the boat back over close enough to get him. But when I did get him and I pulled him up onto the boat, the largest laceration, I could see about 5 inches of flesh, and then his hip bone was protruding. So this was a pretty serious injury, and there was a lot of blood. And We got him back to the marina as quickly as possible. And you ever been so drunk you can drive but you can't walk? Yeah, that describes my state that day, because I was driving the boat and everything, but when I got to get out to go yell call 911, I really couldn't walk. I stumbled my way into the marina. And I got arrested, of course, and thankfully my friend did survive the injuries, but it took more than a year for him to get through all of the rehabilitatory treatments. And you know, that's because I think the rules should apply to you and not to me. And that's because I can't see the connection between the bad stuff that's happening in my life and my decision to drink. I just can't see it. We have a term for that here. We call it insanity, right? Any sane person could clearly diagnose the problem for me and prescribe a course of action. Hey, don't drink anymore, dummy, right? I couldn't see it, and I don't know how to explain that any better. Unfortunately, it was 7 more years before I was to get sober. And thankfully, I didn't put any more propellers through anybody, but I did run tornadoes through people's lives. And what ended up happening in February of 2004 is I finally got my wish. I don't know, did you guys ever grow up wishing you were going to have a surprise party? Right? Yeah? You know, the kind with the pony and the bounce house? Yeah? I always wanted to be surprised with a surprise birthday party, and I got my surprise party. It wasn't like that, though. I was afforded a life-saving opportunity to go and receive treatment for my problem with alcohol and other substances. And I went to a treatment facility, and I learned a lot of really good things, and I met some very nice people. And probably the most valuable thing that they did for me is they told me that when I got home, get a sponsor, go to meetings, go through the steps, change the way you live. But see, that sounds like a rule. And you know what I told you about rules? They really don't have to apply to me. And I got home, and I suppose I had an intention to do what they had suggested. The trouble is that before I even got out of the parking lot from the treatment facility, I managed to find my way into a prescription for some narcotic pain medication. And, you know, I prefer to get drunk, but I'll use just about anything to feel better. And I took about 4 times the prescribed amount, which is technically a relapse. And made my way home. I was undercover. Nobody knew. They couldn't smell the pills on my breath. So nobody knew that I had a new sobriety date. I didn't have a new sobriety date. And I did that for a couple more days until I ran out of those things. And then I found a bottle of I don't know what it was, man. It was something in the bar. It was something in the cabinet, man. I found it and I drank it. And for the next year and a half, I would be confronted by my family, who held true to their promises. See, when they threw that surprise party, they offered me a way out. They said, "We will help you get the help that you need. But if you don't take our help, you will not be welcome in our family activities. You will not be welcome in our homes. You certainly will not drink in our homes." And my family followed through with that. They gave me some tough love. And you know what was tough about that love is how hard it was for them. I'm the guy that you might see from time to time who has his mother and, check this, grandmother walk him into an AA meeting. That's me. I'm that guy. And you know what that, what I know today about that is that that's a clear demonstration of just how much my mother, my family, but in this case specifically my mother and my grandmother, just how much they love me and want me to be well. They don't have a drinking problem. I don't know of anybody in my family that has a drinking problem. And yet they were willing to go to these strange church basements with people they didn't know to try to get their son and their grandson the help that he needed. I'll be forever grateful for that. The trouble is that I can't see it. And so even though I've got Mom and Grandma taking me to meetings, I'm continuing to try to figure out a way that I can have all the things that I want in my life. I want to be able to go to the family stuff and drink other times. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, you might find it very difficult to manage and coordinate those calendars. And so what began to happen was things that didn't belong to me began to disappear from my grandmother's house. And I had an aunt at the time who was, she was dying of cancer. And my, being a dutiful nephew, I would go to visit my aunt, and when she wasn't watching, I'd take a drag off of her bottle of medication that she needed. But see, I needed it. That's what my brain told me. And as a result of this kind of behavior, I put my poor mother in a position where she had to deliver the news that I was banned from Grandma's house. I was no longer welcome. Now, maybe some of you will appreciate this, but the event that precipitated my being banned from Grandmother's house was that some heart medication went missing from my grandmother. I did not take the heart medication. I'm just saying. But you know what? I had just enough clarity in my mind when I got that phone call that I knew that that didn't matter. It didn't matter if I didn't take it that time, because I had been taking it so many other times. There was one suspect right here, baby. And you know what? I deserved to be kicked out of Grandma's house long before that ever happened. And what a shameful thing to put my mother through. When that happened, I had actually started working the steps with my first sponsor. And I had my first spiritual experience about that same time. It happened on a Sunday morning. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I was laying in bed and the sun was coming through the window and it was hitting me right on the face and it was just irritating me. And I really wanted to sleep in that morning and the sun was waking me up. And so I rolled over, stupid sun, you know, and I roll over so I can go back to sleep. And out of nowhere, this thought comes to mind. Okay, here's the thought. You should get down on your knees and pray. What do you say to that? Hell no, I'm rolling over and going back to sleep. I'm not listening to that stupid idea. And I roll over and I try to go back to sleep. And that stupid thought kept coming back. And I rolled over again. And finally I said, fine, I'll say the stupid prayer.
You ain't lying.
And I got down at the end of my bed. Now at that time, I prayed in my thoughts. I don't do that anymore. But at that time, I prayed in my thoughts. And if you could hear my thoughts, I'm not kidding you. This is what you would have heard. Heavenly Father, thank you for another day sober today. I ask that you show me your will. You know, my grandmother had a will. I was supposed to get my grandfather's gold watch. And you know what? I bet you my dad has that. You know, that son of a... He is always taking stuff. And, oh! And about that time, I opened my eyes. And I looked across the bed. And there was a little picture in a frame on my nightstand from when I was in, like, kindergarten or first grade. And I saw that picture. And the picture reminded me of some violence that had taken place between my father and I at about that age. Now, in my prayer, I'm cussing him for keeping the gold watch. And so my prayer continues like this. Yeah, I bet he's got the watch. You know, that son of a... And oh my God, do you remember what he did to that cute little kid? And about that same time, this entirely different idea flooded my mind. And the idea that came to mind was, what are you doing to that kid? Because you know what, man? I had been killing me. I had been outright killing me. I'd like to tell you that at that moment, the scars from the past with my father were healed, and he and I walked hand in hand into the sunset. That's just not what happened. By that time, by the time that occurred, I had been, I think the word is estranged. I had not spoken to my father in about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I was afraid of my dad. I was afraid that, I was afraid of maybe some of that violence. I was afraid of something he might say that would really just cut me straight in the heart. I was afraid that I might say something to him that I would regret. And the only answer that I had up to that time to avoid those things was just to stay away from him. And so that's what I did. Two Christmases, two Thanksgivings, two birthdays, right? All that stuff. And my sponsor started guiding me through the sixth step somewhere shortly after that occurrence, that prayer occurrence. And I don't know if you guys have had this experience either, but when I got to the sixth step, just having finished giving my resentment inventory, my sex inventory, my fear inventory to my sponsor, after that he said, I want you to write down a list of your character defects, your shortcomings. And I said, okay. And I thought really long and hard about this, and I knew this wasn't the right answer, but I was being honest. I was being honest. I told him, I said, turns out I don't have any. yeah. So he emailed me a list of about 150 of them. It was a generic list. And he said, look, just pick the ones that you think you can relate to. And I began to do that. And I think it was organized alphabetically. And so one of the ones that I remember very, very well from that list was arrogant. And you know how I recognize that I was arrogant is that I really hate arrogant people. You know, I really have disdain for people who think they're too good to do what everybody else has to do. You know, and I got to thinking, damn, that kind of sounds like me. In the process of that sixth step, I began to have a new perspective on the relationships in my life. I began to see how I had affected my grandmother and my mom. And my grandmother, I'm the oldest grandson and oldest grandchild for her. And I've always had a special place. She's always treated me special. And it didn't take very long for her to accept me back into her home. And one of the things that I got to do, I thought it was a real pain in the ass at first, but my grandmother began to experience some problems with dementia, and she lost the ability to drive. And she was still living at home, and so what I got to do, what I got to do was take my grandmother shopping every Saturday to the grocery store for about 4.5 years. And that's really not a big payback, but in a little way, it restored a lot of the relationship with her. And after 4.5 years, she had diminished to a point where she could no longer live at home. And so then instead of taking her grocery shopping, I would go visit her at the long-term facility that she was in. And I got an opportunity before things got too far down that path early on. I got an opportunity to share with her how I understood that I had harmed her. You know, there were so many years. I'd be at grandma's house with my mom and everybody else on a Christmas night, right? And I would be lit, and they'd watch me leave the house, get in the car, and drive away. And it never occurred to me how absolutely frightening that left them. They were terrified that my mom was terrified her son, and my grandmother was terrified that her favorite grandson. This is recorded, right? I want to make sure my nephew's in. They were afraid about what was going to happen to me, and I got a chance to address that with her. And my grandmother died a couple years ago now, and I want to tell you that when we were there in the room with her right at the very end, I had an immense sense of peace knowing that I had cleaned the slate with her. I was clean with her, man. And I got the opportunity. My family actually asked me to deliver her eulogy at the funeral. Now, this is the guy that 10 years earlier had been banned. And I'm now asked to give her eulogy. To me, that was a really special deal. And at the end of the ceremony, as we walked past her in the casket, I put my 10-year chip in between her hands. One of my friends said, you know, if they ever dig her up, they're going to think she was only 10 years sober when she died. I told you about my father and some of the past. I got an opportunity to make amends with my father. How that started was I still am an active participant in a men's stag meeting where the members of our fellowship show up and they get real. And in places like that, I feel comfortable sharing things that I'm afraid of. And I told my friends at that meeting that my father had invited me to go to a football game with him. And I was afraid to go because I had done that in the past with him. And when I had done that, I'd gotten really loaded. And I was also afraid still about the things that were going on with him and me. And so one of the guys in my men's group, Larry, he said, hey, man, check it out. I didn't get sober until after my father had passed. And from my perspective, let me encourage you to get over your fear and don't miss this opportunity to set things right with your father. And I thought, yeah, that sounds good, whatever. And my friend Michael said, hey, dummy, because I'd mentioned, I said, well, maybe next time he invites me to go to a football game, I'll go with him. And Michael said, hey, dummy, why don't you buy the tickets? Wow. And I'm delighted to tell you that I've done both of those things, but I was afraid. And the way I got over that was I sought some outside help. I spoke with a therapist who was very helpful in helping me to reshape my thinking and my behavior around my father. And one of the things that was suggested that maybe it would be safe to have lunch with my dad. Now, one of the questions that I encountered before I became willing to entertain that thought very seriously was, I thought about, because I don't have any of my own children, but I thought, if I had a son, what would I want that relationship to look like? And then the way my sponsor likes to turn questions around on me, he said, okay, so now are you being that son? And I knew that I wasn't. And so it was out of a desire to be the kind of son that I would want to have that I became willing to pick up the phone and call my dad and ask him if he'd like to have lunch. And we developed this routine over a period of months where I would call him and we'd talk about where we were going to meet, and then the conversation would be over. Let me just ask you, when you're done talking to your parents, what's the last thing that you say?
I love you.
Oh, you guys know, sure. Show off, go ahead. I knew that too, right? But I was not there, man. I was totally not there. And I say I made a mistake. It was the best mistake I ever made, if it was a mistake. But I made the mistake of telling my sponsor about this. And he told me, he said, you know what? You need to do what you know is right. And I was afraid. Now, one of those conversations, as it was ending, I said, hey, Dad, I love you. And I caught him off guard. He didn't know what to do. He kind of stalled, and then the phone went dead. And I thought, awesome, I win. I don't have to do this again, right? And I went back and told my sponsor that, and he said, well, no, see, because we don't stop doing the right thing because we don't get the results we were hoping for. Damn it. So the next time I talked to my dad, I said it again. And this time, I guess he might have saw it coming, and he said, I love you too. And that went on for a little while. And we began to have lunch more regularly. And then there was the day when he said it first. Now, I would have bet you every cent that I have or ever will have that I do not need my father in my life. I do not want my father in my life. I do not need his approval. I don't need his affection, and I certainly don't need his love. And on that day, I learned that I would have lost that bet. But I never would have known that truth if I hadn't had that experience. And that's what we do here in AA, is we have experiences. And they change our lives. I need to tell you that it was about 2 months later that my father had a stroke. And he's alive and he's in fairly good health today, but he lost the ability to speak. Is that odd? Some kind of coincidence, huh? I came, call it 8 weeks. I came 8 weeks from missing that. You can't get that experience back. You either have it or you don't. There's no middle of the road. And I almost missed it because of my pride and my fear. I told you about the friend with the boat. I was 4 years sober before I was ready to overcome that fear. And I went over the amends several times with my sponsor. He helped me to edit what I was going to say. I made an appointment to meet my friend Gavin. And at the last minute, his plans changed and we weren't able to meet. And I spent the next several years trying to reorchestrate a meeting with him. I found him on Facebook, and I'd call him and leave him messages, and I could never catch him live. I could never get him to respond. And, you know, look, I mean, you do that to somebody, you kind of expect they're not going to want to still be chummy with you, right? So I presumed that my friend was still sore at me, and I thought he had every right to be. And I got to my ninth year. Now, I want to be clear about something. What I'm hoping to do tonight is share with you what's happened to me. I'm not here telling you what you ought to do. I don't know what you ought to do. But what I have done in the last 2 days, 1 month, and 12 years since I took my last drink, is I have done my best to apply the 12 steps to my life. Some days it looks pretty good. Some days it looks pretty poor. But in the process of doing that, I have had the opportunity to go through the steps with a number of sponsors. Some of them have moved away. A couple of them have died. And so I've had the opportunity to work through the steps a number of times. And every year when I came up to that ninth step, I just really struggled with this amend because I tried to make it and I couldn't and I didn't know what to do. And my sponsor told me at one point, he said, you know, there's a difference between being willing to make your amends wherever possible and stalking someone. And he said, you know, you have to read the rest of that step. It says, unless to do so would harm others, them or others, right? And he said, your friend's behavior is illustrating that he has no interest in talking to you. pretty clearly. And again, I couldn't see it. All I could see was how I wanted to get free. And so what I committed to do was just carrying the amends around in my car and waiting until he crosses my path, because when God wants him to, he will. And in my ninth year, coming up again the ninth step, again, I encountered this and I just really struggled with it. And this time, something entirely different occurred to me. The idea that occurred to me is, you know what, you've never attempted to make amends to his family. Now, I need to tell you a little bit more of this story. My friend Gavin was, for a few years, my brother-in-law. He was married to my sister. And so the plot thickens, right? So I've been to Christmases and Thanksgivings at this family's house. And what had started happening in the ninth year is I would find myself at restaurants. Now, of course, after my sister and he divorced, then, you know, there's this weird space between you, right? So I'm not going there for Christmas and Thanksgiving anymore. But and then I run the kid over with a boat, and, you know, it gets even weirder, right? And so in my ninth year, I'm running into his family in public places. And when I see them, I get really uptight. And see, I'm not paying attention. My sponsors taught me, anytime I'm upset, there's a problem with me. And I'm not seeing it. And so as I'm going through this ninth step, I probably heard somebody say it because I'm not smart enough to think of it on my own. But the idea came up that, you know what, you've never approached his parents. Now, his mom and dad got a call from the sheriff or the hospital, and they said, your son has been seriously injured in a boating accident. He's being rushed into emergency surgery. And they got no more news for the next 6 hours while they drove across the desert to get to the hospital. I can't imagine the turmoil and the just terrible fear that they must have been sitting in that entire drive. And all of a sudden, now that I'm focusing my attention to his family, I'm thinking about that. And I get to write all that out. And I made a phone call to make an appointment to meet with his parents. And his mom answered the phone. I was actually really hoping that his dad would answer the phone, because his mom was this real protective kind of mother, and his dad was really laid back. And she answered the phone, and I told her who it was, and, you know, she went silent, because why in the heck would I be calling, you know? And I just told her, I said, you know, I've owed you a conversation for some time now. It's long overdue, and I'd like to make an appointment to meet with you and your husband to talk about it. And she said, you know, my husband's in late stages of cancer treatment. We've got our hands full with that. We just really don't have time to meet with you. If you have something you need to say, can you just say it? And the voice of my sponsors echoing in my head, you know, is, you don't call these in, right? And so I'm thinking, well, but, you know, and then this other thought occurred to me, and it was, why don't you be compassionate? This poor woman has got her hands full with she's going to lose her husband. Give her what she wants. So I got to tell her that I understood what I had done to her. And I got to tell her that I wasn't living that way anymore. And I got to tell her that I was helping other men who were just as sick as I have been. And she, when I told her, you know, I it was an accident, but nevertheless, I harmed your son. She says, oh, honey, everybody makes mistakes. And I said, well, okay, but you got to admit that's a pretty big one. And she goes, well, I'll give you that. And I got done talking with her, and I don't expect to be invited to Christmas, but I have seen them. I have seen them since. And I'm free. I am free. I told her at the end of the conversation that I had been trying to reach her son to share this same message with him, and that I hadn't been able to reach him. And I understood that he might still be very angry with me. And she said, oh, he was joking when we got to the hospital. He's never been angry with you. And she said, you know, he's remarried and just had his first child with his new wife. And I'm reasonably certain that the reason he won't contact you is because as out of respect for his current wife. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, duh, that makes perfect sense, right? And so, again, I get free of these things by following this process. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share those stories with you. And I do hope that you can find for yourself every bit of the recovery and the miracle that I've experienced here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.